Good evening, everyone. Yeah, I decided that since we have 3 weeks between this class and the next class, rather than start a new sutta today and then wait 3 weeks before resuming, in that time you forget everything that we've covered today, that what I would do today would take a survey or make a resume of the Alagadupama Sutta from start to finish. Because we did that sutta taking each section in great detail, and by taking it in that way, one loses sight of the overall structure of that sutta. In fact, maybe in some parts that there might not even be a very clear-cut structure. In fact, there are some places where I can see the reason for the transition from one section to the other. But we could take an overall view and try to see where there are logical transitions from one section to the next, and then see which are the sections where there seems to be a kind of, let's say, a logical jump from one section to another that is not so easy to fill in. So I've tried mapping out the progression of the sutta from section to section. And so now we begin with this case where a monk named Arita has been promulgating what is called the pernicious view, a pernicious wrong view. And this view is considered to be pernicious for, we could say, two reasons. There seem to be two reasons why it's considered especially dangerous or almost subversive in the Sangha. Okay, so this is the way I map this out. Okay, so why is this view considered to be especially pernicious or subversive? One is that what is not explicitly stated, but it's kind of very clear from the actual wording of what is said in Arita's statement, is that his view presents a challenge to one of the Buddha's grounds of self-confidence. One of the Buddha's grounds of self-confidence is that the things that he calls obstructions are able to obstruct one who indulges in them. And Arita is saying exactly the opposite, that for one who indulges in those things that are called obstructions by the Blessed One, those things are not able to obstruct their progress. I think it's the third ground of self-confidence. You find these in Majjhima Nikaya number 12. And then the second sort of subversive tendency, a subversive implication in Arita's view, and again it's present, we could see it from the text only by implication, from the way the monks try to refute Arita, and that is that what Arita has been saying is that to indulge in sensual pleasures is not an obstruction to one's spiritual progress. And he seems to be promulgating this view with special reference to monks, that almost as though he's saying that it's all right for monks to enjoy sensual pleasures. And almost challenging those rules of the Buddha which inculcate, which advocate, or which impose sensual restraint. So he seems to be advocating sensual indulgence. Okay, so when the monks are not able to succeed in dissuading Arita from this wrong view, eventually they bring him to the Buddha, and then the Buddha engages Arita in discussion, and so the Buddha's refutation of Arita reaffirms or reestablishes two things. First, that you could say that it reaffirms this third ground of self-confidence of the Buddha. So it reaffirms that obstructive things are obstructions. And then it reaffirms that sensual pleasures are truly do lead to suffering, bondage, and defilement. Reputation is too much of a logical term. Rebuttal would be a better term. So then this eventually leads us... Okay, now, an important phrase that we come to in the course of this discussion is on the top of page 226, in the third line, that you misguided man, and here I would change the translation a little bit, you misguided man by your wrong grasp have misrepresented us and injured yourself and stored up much demerit, for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. So we should sort of underline this expression, wrong grasp, because that will lead into what comes next. And what comes next is the simile of the snake, which gives its title to the sutta. And the simile of the snake, it's laid out in two main sections. One shows the wrong approach to the Dhamma, the other, the right approach. Okay, the wrong approach is what are called Mogapurisa, which means, translated, misguided men, empty-headed men, learn the Dhamma, but they don't examine the meaning of the teachings with wisdom. They learn the Dhamma basically only for the sake of criticizing others and engaging in debates. And then the Buddha says here, these teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. Why is that? Because of the wrong grasp of those teachings. Again, we have that expression, wrong grasp. So that's become now, you see, that kind of motif or theme running through this first part of the sutta, the wrong grasp. And that's what's illustrated by the wrong way of catching this water snake. The water snake has some venom that can be used for making medicine. But if one goes to catch it, and one grabs it in the wrong way, one grabs it by the tail, the snake will turn around and bite one, and then one will die or suffer. So why is that? Because of the wrong grasp of the snake. Okay, then in contrast to that are those clansmen, that is, young men, let's be more liberal, young men and women, who learn the Dhamma, and then when they learn the Dhamma, they examine the meaning of the teachings with wisdom. They gain a reflective acceptance of them, and then they experience the good or the benefit for the sake of which they learn the Dhamma. Okay, and so now by these people, these Dhamma students who are approaching the Dhamma correctly, these teachings have been rightly grasped by them, and so the teachings will lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time. So why is that? Because of the right grasp of those teachings. Okay, so we can say that the second section, which has centers on the simile of the snake, and this right grasp of the teaching, this is like grasping the snake, or it's like catching the snake by using the cleft stick. One uses the stick to catch the snake by the head so that the snake can't move the head. And then one uses the hand to grab the snake around the neck so that it can turn back and bite. Then one takes the snake and throws it into a bag and closes the bag and happily takes it back home. Grasping snake safely. Okay, so now we have a contrast set up here between the wrong grasp of the teaching and the right grasp of the teaching. And so this might lead to a misunderstanding that one could grasp the teaching in some way and get away with it. So now the Buddha introduces another simile to show that the teaching is really not for grasping at all. And this is the famous simile of the raft. And in this simile, he gives the story of a man who comes to a body of water, dangerous. The place where he's staying on this shore, it's dangerous. He wants to get across to the further shore, which is safe and secure. There's no ferry boat, no bridge, and so he constructs a raft by himself. He builds the raft from twigs, grass, branches, and uses it to get across to the further shore. Okay, there is the wrong approach with the raft. Once he gets across, he puts the raft on his head and goes about thinking that this is the way to treat the raft. Out of gratitude for the raft, he's going to carry the raft around. Okay, the Buddha says that is not using the raft rightly. And so what the man should do is he builds the raft, goes across, and once he gets across, then he leaves the raft behind. When we came to that passage, when we were studying the sutta section by section, I said that the simile doesn't actually work out well if you try to follow it too literally, because the person who gets to the other shore is actually the arahant, who will naturally not cling anyway. And the person who is making the effort to get across will be one who is earnestly training. And the people who are on this shore usually don't make an effort to get across. They're the ones who, on this shore, they put the raft on their head and walk around with it. But the simile, again, I say one shouldn't try to interpret it too literally, but the point of the simile is simply that the Dhamma, the teaching, is for the purpose of crossing over and not for the purpose of grasping. And here I have to say that the right grasp of the teaching is actually a grasp which is not a grasping. And it's the wrong grasp which is a grasping. One might phrase it that way. So it's easy for people to deceive themselves and think that because they become very learned, they think that they're grasping the teaching rightly, because they could be clinging to it in a very subtle way. And so the Buddha, through this simile of the raft, he is really sort of underscoring the point that one shouldn't be clinging, even in the subtlest way. But this doesn't mean that one, I have to add, that one gives up the teaching or abandons the teaching. Even when one gets across, that one has no longer any use to practice the teaching to go any further. But even an arahant will still propagate the teaching in order to benefit others. So he'll still uphold the teaching. Sometimes people, again, these are the people on this shore, think after studying a little Buddhism, practicing a little, think you could just throw the teachings away and start acting wildly and doing anything one wants as proof that they're enlightened. Okay, now from paragraph 14 to paragraph 15, now it seems at one level that there's been a kind of leap or change in subject matter. That now the teaching is no longer just progressing in a simple linear sequence, or a direct linear sequence, quite a clear logical sequence. But now just like a new theme has been introduced, something that doesn't seem to follow so clearly from what has been presented earlier. But this is the way I see, if I were to try to explain why this idea of the six standpoints for views has been introduced. I'm not going to go on writing and writing on the board. It's a little tiring. Okay, but this is why I would, this is the way I would see why the six standpoints for views is introduced. Perhaps it is because the Buddha is taking up the subject of upadana, clinging, as a kind of theme for examination. And now one big area of clinging is sensual clinging, clinging to sense pleasures. And that seems to have been the problem that was underlying. There's actually clinging to sense pleasures and clinging to views. Those are two types of clinging. And those two types of clinging, they came together in the wrong view of the monk Arita, who is in effect saying that there's no harm, no obstruction to progress in the indulgence and sense pleasures. And now the other big area in which upadana operates is the clinging to the idea of self. And this expresses itself in views of self and subtler defilements which connect to the idea of self. And so now the Buddha switches over to that area of the idea of self and views of self by taking up these six standpoints for views, which when you look at them, you could see that they are all views which are concerned with the subject, the theme of what is the self, what am I? And again, the subject is presented through a contrast between the ordinary, uninstructed world person, the person of the worldling, who is victimized by these views of self, who buys into them and accepts them. And on the other hand, the wise, instructed, noble disciple who is able to see through these views of self and doesn't accept any of them. Okay, and this section ends with this Buddha making the statement that one who sees through these views of self is not agitated about what is non-existent. And that statement opens up the door to a new section. And this new section begins when a monk in the audience picks up on this word, not agitated. And then asks about agitation. This word agitation, as I explained when we dealt with this section, has the two senses, two meanings of sort of overlapping meanings of craving and fear. And so we have, this is useful to illustrate, to map out graphically, so I'll put this on the board. The four ways in which agitation is considered. Can I erase this? Okay, so the section on agitation, we begin with the question about whether there can be agitation about what is non-existent externally. And then the Buddha illustrates this and says that there is. He illustrates this with the case of somebody who laments or grieves over losing possessions that he had, or who grieves over failing to get something that he wanted to possess. And then the no agitation about what is non-existent externally is just the opposite. Somebody doesn't have any sorrow or grief about these cases. Okay, then the next consideration is agitation about what is non-existent internally. And this, from the explanation of it, is pointing to the non-existence of a self which is permanent, eternal, and everlasting. And so when a worldling or somebody with a strong clinging to a view of a permanent and eternal self hears the Buddha or Buddha's disciple teaching about the eradication, the elimination of all views and clinging to self, then that person becomes upset, agitated, disturbed, worried, thinking, I shall be annihilated, I shall be destroyed. But when a person without such strong, but when a person without attachment to the view of self hears the Buddha teaching in such a way, then he doesn't have this agitation, doesn't give rise to these thoughts. Okay, now then we come to section 22. And now this here, we're now moving still in the same area, but now we have a three-point examination. The 3 points brought up for consideration. That is, one is possessions, whether there are any possessions that are eternal, whether there are any doctrines of self that can be clung to without giving rise to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, and whether there are any views that one can rely on that would not give rise to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And those three are negated. And here we might take the rejection of any kind of permanent, everlasting, eternal possessions to refer also to, it seems to connect to paragraph 18, that whatever possessions, or actually to paragraph 18 and 19, that whatever possessions there are necessarily impermanent. And so if one recognizes that the possessions are impermanent, then one will not feel sorrow and grief when they vanish and disappear. But if one clings to them as being permanent and eternal, then when one loses them, then one will be like the person in paragraph 18 who weeps and laments when they vanish. And then paragraph 23, one could see that connects to paragraph 20 and 21. Somebody who clings to this doctrine of self, this person will be full of agitation if he meets with the Buddha's teaching of non-self. But if the person doesn't cling to any doctrine of self, then the person will even welcome and delight in the Buddha's teaching of non-self. And it seems that the paragraph on the teaching on not taking any support, not finding any support in views, it's almost unnecessary. It just seems to me that the text would have been quite adequate just with paragraph 22 and 23. So maybe paragraph 24 could be referring back to the view of Arita, because Arita that was the monk, was the one who was firmly attached to that view. And so that could be the reason why this was brought in order to show the danger of becoming attached to, especially to these pernicious views.
In section 15,
yeah,
the Buddha mentions six standpoints for views.
Yeah.
First of all, the Buddha mentions material form,
yeah,
and then feelings, and then formations.
Perception, then formation.
And in this way, it seems, looks like the Buddha is going to talk about five aggregates.
Yeah.
But the Buddha does not do this way.
Yeah.
And instead, he talks about what is...
Seen, heard, sense.
Yeah.
It's like the sense object.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would like to know the reason.
I think maybe, did I deal with this passage when you were away? I'm not sure. Because I think I said that I really don't know the reason.
Possible that the Buddha is talking about sensual pleasure. These are the objects.
Ah, that's an interesting observation. But it would really be a pretty indirect way to go about that. Because usually when the Buddha is speaking about sense pleasures, he speaks about there's a fixed formula that we meet in the text. There are forms cognizable by the eye that are desirable, likable, pleasurable, provocative of lust. Chakuvinyeya. Anyway, I don't have to quote the Pali right now. But there's a fixed formula for dealing with sensual pleasures. But it's possible. There's no further explanation why the Buddha uses this approach, either in the sutta itself, or I think I looked that up in the commentary, and the commentary didn't even give an explanation, if I remember, didn't give an explanation of that. So, is anybody's guess why? And I don't have a clear explanation, authoritative explanation myself. But it could be, especially because it's followed by this formulation of a very strong eternalist view. So we could take that expression replacing consciousness with that formula to represent sense pleasures, and then the other, what follows it, to represent view of self, a very strong view of eternal, permanent self. Maybe.
Or is it possible this part of the sutta is somewhat combined? It is combined in other places.
Combined in other places?
This part of the sutta,
yeah,
actually the Buddha does not gave the teaching at the one time, probably later on edited in this way.
Edited in this way. I tend to doubt that for the reason that what tends to happen with editing is editing tends to standardize a teaching. So when one comes across very sometimes, of course, sometimes variations could come in through clumsy editing. But usually when one sees variations where one would expect uniformity, sometimes that could indicate a more archaic and more original text, therefore a more authentic, more genuine version. So like, say, if I'm an editor, several centuries later, I come across something like this, I say, ah, this must be a mistake. What's really meant is the vijnana khanda, the aggregate of consciousness. So then I would cross that out and replace, he regards consciousness thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. You see, because I'm coming later, so I would put in what is the standard version. But it could be that the older version was the one that was developing the variation on the theme. And it's these sort of clumsy editors that come in and think that everything has to be manufactured exactly to fit of the same pattern. If any, when I'm giving this explanation, if anybody has any questions or any comments at any point, just feel free to come in. Okay, so then we go from the section on no support for views. Then we reduce to just the commentary calls, says that the section on no permanent possession, no view of self to cling to, no support for views, it calls this the section on three-pointed emptiness, tikoti sunyata, was things are devoid of permanent possession, a good view of self, or a good doctrine of self, a good support for views. In the next section, the commentary calls two-pointed emptiness, which is the emptiness of a self, emptiness of anything belonging to a self. Because the Buddha says, a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended as true and established. Okay, from that point, now the Buddha apparently backtracks, it seems to me to be backtracking, to go into the standard for this. Almost looks to me almost as though this could have been an editorial insertion on the three, this questionnaire on the three characteristics, maybe. But anyway, it builds up through the standard questionnaire on impermanence, suffering, regarding the five aggregates, coming to the five aggregates is not mine, not I, not myself. Then one considers the five aggregates as being not mine, not I, not myself. Then to disenchantment, dispassion, liberation, the fruit of liberation. All of this is to show how, yes, this whole series is to show, we could say this, to show the point of the teaching of anatta. Okay, now that the Buddha has the Buddha has been rejecting these views of self all along, but he's not yet shown the point of the teaching of non-self, what it's really intended to lead to. But now, with this section, he's showing that the teaching of non-self, or the rejection of views of self, is not just adopting one philosophical standpoint against other philosophical standpoints, but it's a particular, call it a tool of contemplation, a tool of investigation to be used within the meditative framework in order to eradicate ignorance and clinging and then to reach the fruit of liberation. And then in the next series of passages, or the next passage, through a series of similes, the Buddha shows the arahant as one who has eliminated all of these defilements, barriers, obstacles, fetters, and so on. And then that section or that passage culminates in that statement, which I'm not really able to understand very well. He says that when the gods with Indra, with Brahma and Prajapati seek a monk who is thus liberated in mind, they do not find anything of which they could say the consciousness of oneness gone, or the Tathagata, is supported by this. And why is that? One thus gone, that is the Tathagata, is untraceable here and now, cannot be found here and now. Okay, then we come to the section on the misrepresentation of the Tathagata. And then in this section, the Buddha shows how he himself is unmoved or indifferent to, on the one hand, abuse, on the other hand, to honor, respect, and veneration. Doesn't feel bitterness, sadness, rejection if others criticize him, scold him, harass him. And he doesn't feel joy and delight if others praise him and venerate him. And this shows, and then the Buddha gives advice to the monks that they too should develop a mind which is free from this attachment to praise, honor, and veneration, and which is afraid or dejected by being abused, reviled, scolded, and so on. Now, I think the point of this passage, the way it fits into the sutta, is also to be taken in connection with the teaching of non-self, anatta. That is, the reason why one becomes elated in one case and downcast in the other case is because of the subtle clinging to I and mine. So one who is completely free of any idea of I and mine, when there's praise, blame, honor, dishonor, they have no effect on that person. Okay, and then, as if to again underscore that from another angle, or if perhaps to show like the underlying reason for that attitude of equanimity in the face of praise and blame, the Buddha gives us teaching on abandoning what is not yours. And that is abandoning the five aggregates, or as the commentary explains, abandoning attachment and identification, attachment to and identification with the five aggregates. And then the Buddha gives another very memorable simile. He compares the five aggregates, where he asked the monks whether they would be upset and disturbed if people were to carry off the sticks, branches, and leaves of Jeta's grove. And the monks say, of course not. And so the Buddha says, and the reason is because the grass, twigs, branches, and Jeta's grove are not us. not, they don't belong to us. And so the Buddha says, in the same way, bodily form, feeling, perception, the mental formations, consciousness, that is not yours, abandon it. Feeling, not yours. Perception, not yours. Formations, consciousness, not yours. Abandon it. Okay, and then the last passage, again, it doesn't follow in a strictly logical progression from what comes earlier. In fact, it almost, in a way, backtracks a little. Well, actually, no, it doesn't backtrack, because it begins... In this passage, the Buddha is going to show the individuals who have reached the different stages of realization in his teaching. But this is to... The reason why the Buddha is going to show these individuals is as a way of substantiating his claim that this Dhamma that he teaches is well proclaimed, clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork. And so he says, in this Dhamma, in this teaching, there are monks who are arahants, monks who are non-returners, monks who are once returners, monks who are stream enterers. And I should add here that the Buddha is using the word bhikkhus or monks because he's addressing monks. But in fact, if you look at sutta number 73, the Buddha says that within this Dhamma and discipline, he speaks about the different classes from his different classes of followers that have reached these different levels of attainment. And in the class of arahants, he has just the monks and nuns, but in the other stages, the non-returners, then the once-returners and stream-enterers, he has both monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers. Okay, we come to monks who are stream enterers. Then paragraph 46 takes us to those who are disciples who are on the path to stream entry. These are called either Dhamma followers or faith followers. Sadhanusari, those are faith followers, and Dhammanusari, those are Dhamma followers. The Dhamma followers are those who have wisdom as their dominant faculty. The faith followers, those who have faith as their dominant faculty. But in fact, whether they're faith followers or Dhamma followers, both have to achieve realization through wisdom. But they differ by way of what I call the driving force, the motivating force in their practice of the path. And then paragraph 47, the closing paragraph, says that even those who have, I translate it as sufficient faith in me, sufficient love for me, are all headed for heaven. They are not necessarily on any stage of enlightenment. They're not bound for liberation. But the question comes up, how much faith, how much love is necessary? And what the commentary says is that these are practitioners, they're not just ordinary devotees, ordinary Buddhist devotees. These are practitioners who have reached a certain stage of insight, who have gotten very clear, right view through development of insight. And they've clarified the right view of non-self, through personal insight. They haven't achieved realization of non-self, but they've clarified their view of self, of non-self, through the development of insight. They've clarified their understanding of conditionality and dependent origination through the development of insight. And through their understanding of the Dhamma, through personal practice of insight, they have this strong faith and devotion towards the Buddha. The commentary says that the ancients, that's the old teachers in India, used to call them Chula Sotapanna, which means little stream enterers. That they're not real stream enterers, but they are kind of, by reason of their clear understanding, they are almost like stream enterers. Okay, if there are questions or comments, then please feel welcome.
Going back to the side of the rabbit. Can you explain briefly the difference between using the teachings and grasping
them? I would say that grasping the teaching would be illustrated by the case of somebody who just learns the teachings, holds to them intellectually, likes to use them to maybe to show off. My mind goes back to the types of people that I know who like to argue about the teaching, to they're not the type who just go around criticizing others, but they sort of show off their knowledge about the teaching. They hold to views about the teaching, fixed views about the teaching, but don't practice it.
Wouldn't that be covered by the wrong grasping of the teaching? Recently the snake? You said that the right grasping is no grasping at all. I guess I'm having a hard time with that concept because he does say, you assume the snake is a long way, a right way to grasp. And then he says, you use the raft across the
river. So
that's
what he
said,
too,
grasping the raft until you cross the river.
Let us say, okay. You see, there's an ambiguity or an ambivalence in the word. Even in the Pali word gahana or gaha, it can signify, it's somewhat like the English word grasping too, that one has a right grasp of something, it means a right understanding. But the word grasping could also signify that mental attitude of tenaciousness, of holding something tightly and just using it as something like a system of mental constructs that one latches onto and then doesn't apply. Okay, and so right grasping means that one has a right understanding and one applies that right understanding by putting that understanding to work in practice. But in the course of that practice, one does have the right understanding. It's not that one just gives up all intellectual or conceptual understanding altogether. Okay, and so when I say that any kind of grasping is by definition wrong grasping, what I mean is that tenacious hold that refuses to let go. Not allowing anything to be questioned.
I would say that would be grasping at teaching.
That would be, I would say that would be a good indication of that's a good point. That would be a kind of symptom of a grasping attitude. Okay, just for the sake of the recorder, let me just say, okay, his point is that not allowing questioning of anything that the Buddha taught would be indicative of grasping at the teaching. Yeah, that would be the kind of attitude, the kind of, I have to say sometimes I find that in myself too, especially when people are questioning my interpretations. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. When it's taught openly, yeah, not when it's concealed.
There's nothing to give. There is no point not to discuss.
Yeah, no point that shouldn't be discussed, that can't be discussed. Yeah.
In the Dhamma, there is no place to.
And nothing hidden, nothing that can't be discussed.
And the section where he's talking about the standpoint from the
six standpoints of views, yeah.
The leap seems, I think, tell me if I'm understanding this correctly, it seems to be a teaching tool that he's come to the monk, said, okay, the monks have come to him and said, okay, this guy, he said X, Y, and Z, we know he's wrong, we tried to convince him he's wrong, can you help us? And the Buddha has first chided Arita,
yeah.
And then also chided questioned them to make sure that they understand at least the sensual portion.
Yeah.
Because when I go back and read it, to me it seems like their response to Arita is just in terms of the sensual craving. Whereas Arita's wrong view is in those two pieces. It's in the sensual desire portion and also in the wrong view portion.
Mm-hmm.
So the Buddha looked at their answer and said, okay, well, you responded to him, but you only responded to half of the problem, and that there's this other thing, and I want to make sure that you monks understand the whole picture behind upadana.
Upadana, yeah.
Does that make sense?
That's a very good way to put it, yeah. Okay. So, let me just rephrase it. It seems similar to what I said. Okay. Arita expressed a wrong view dealing with sensual pleasures. Okay, and when the Buddha interrogated them, he saw that they were aware of that they had caught up Arita insofar as there was a misunderstanding of sensual pleasures. But now he wanted to make sure that they understood, let's say, the range of types of wrong view. And so now he was going into what I call the different area. They call it the counterpart area of wrong views. Wrong views concerning sensual pleasures and then wrong view concerning self. That seems to be right, yeah. Or at least that's the way I would understand it, too. Did anybody have any ideas about paragraph 36?
Because it is in contrary to the arahant state, mind state, or Tathagata's mind state.
It's not so clear to me. Maybe you have to write it out. Still don't get it so clearly. I'll have to think about it. It's somewhat anyway, it's.
This is, I think, the Buddha wants to use this evidence to prove that Arita's view is the wrong view.
at this point that the Buddha's left Arita way behind? It seems to me, at this point in the sutta. Anyway, it would take more thought. I mean, I've thought about this a lot, and still the passage is somewhat difficult for me. But I would still be hesitant to connect this too much with the wrong view of Arita.
Could he connect with any wrong view? Or by saying that our heart's consciousness does not abide in
one? The consciousness of one
does not abide in any.
Of course, one would say that the consciousness of the arhat is not supported by anything, in the sense of it's not attached to anything. Maybe one could take this. I think I could see now. Take this in connection with Sutta number 143, Sariputta's advice to Anathapindika on his deathbed. But I think we have to end. Yeah, we're past
there's
it.
There's another sutta
I think sutta number 143 might give a good, seen as a good way to interpret that statement. Yeah, the advice to Anathapindika when he's dying. Okay, let us end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Sata Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya.